Winemakers and winery owners all come with different backgrounds, but Ryan Zapaltis, owner of Zapaltis Wines, may be the most extreme. Ryan is a confirmed skateboard addict with a strong working class background, and he is yet another former Wisconsinite, plus another strong rosé advocate. Life Between the Vines partner Jeff McClellan makes his debut on this interview, as ironically, I was in California gathering more interviews.
I'd like to welcome Ryan Zapaltis to the world headquarters of Life Between the Vines. Thanks, Ryan, for coming here so early in the morning.
Hey, great to be here. I'm a morning person, believe it or not, so it's good to be back in Wisconsin. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Now, you grew up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I understand.
And I did.
So what took you out to California?
Well, basically, I finished school and I had no goals, no direction. Well, I mean, I finished school and I basically just wanted to, you know, the summer after I finished college, I was like, I think I'll just go out to California. My godmother was living out there, and so I had a sort of a place to stay. And I did go out there to basically be a skate bum and just live the lifestyle of that, see what was happening. I think I was doing okay as a skateboarder, maybe had a chance to go professional or whatever. And so I just moved out there just to kind of live that lifestyle for a while. And I had some good things happen, had a few sponsors and stuff along the way. But as my body got a little older, I cared less about doing that, even though I had some pretty cool things happen in the skate world. But sort of discovered the wine thing along the way.
Now, I think you have a fairly unique story. Tell us a little bit of how you got into it. Now, when you moved out to California, you were in Sebastopol. Was that right?
Yep, I moved in with my godmother, who's living in Sebastopol. And she was working in the wine industry herself. And so that first summer living with them, I was exposed to good food, good wine. You know, she worked in the wine industry, so obviously there's great bottles at home all the time. They're a really festive family. My family is. I love to cook, love to have big parties, and being out in West County, Sebastopol, there's just so much great food, local products. So it was pretty easy to get immersed in it quickly. So that first summer, I was exposed to wines I never could afford to drink.
Yeah.
You know, tasted some fancy cabs, some great pinots, just everything. And so by the end of summer, I was kind of just doing odd jobs throughout the summer. And then I met a guy who ran the cellar at La Crema, and he offered me a job. He says, why don't you come work harvest? It's not glorious, but it's a should be a good time. So in late August, I started working for La Crema Winery, and then harvest hit, and all of a sudden we're working, you know, 15-hour days, and I just fell in love with the process. Well, simultaneously, I was liking wine, too. I love the process, and I love culture and wine. So I ended up working there for about 2 years, became a full-time employee, and just really became obsessed with learning about wine, the process of making wine, is also the culture and just the whole wine scene itself. So I kind of fast-tracked in those 2 years, just really getting into wine, exploring different wines, just trying to learn, go tasting different wineries and all that. So the assistant winemaker at La Crema, after a couple of years, this guy named TJ Evans, I think he knew that I was kind of really into it. And he says, dude, you got to get out of here and you got to go like work down under, go do some internships in different places to see if you really want to do the wine thing, because he could see that my curiosity was really peaked.
Yeah. So you ended up in New Zealand then, right, for a while?
Yeah, he helped me get a job for harvest in 2000 at Villa Maria, where he had worked. He had a connection there, so he put in a recommendation for me. And so just through a few emails, I got a work visa together, and I headed down to New Zealand. So immediately after finishing the 99 harvest in California, did the 2000 harvest in New Zealand. So back-to-back harvests, because they're Southern Hemisphere. So you start harvesting in February and March. So it was pretty cool. And down there, I really enjoyed it. I worked at a medium-sized facility. And I think that the ownership or the winemaker down there thought I knew more than I did. So they gave me a lot of responsibility. And I was like, all right, I guess I don't really know what I'm doing, but, you know, I figured it out. And they taught me a lot of things, a little more technical stuff. I was doing some lab work, doing, I guess, a little more advanced cellar work. Just kind of at that point, working that harvest, became the turning point where I decided winemaking is what I want to do. I want to do this for life. I was hooked, you know.
Yeah.
The curiosity melted into obsession, so
Was there a specific event that really triggered this, like a certain incident that happened or this experience of working in the harvest?
I think just the overall feeling I had being down there and being really immersed in it. Working my first couple harvests at La Crema, bigger production facility. It was a little, it had a little less soul to it, but I started working down in New Zealand, small facility, small lots. You could really, I just felt like I was just multitasking and it was very exciting. There wasn't really one epiphany. There's just been many along the way, and I still have them to this day, you know. So that's the cool thing about wine is you'll never know everything about making wine and you'll never know everything about the wines of the world. So it's a lifetime education. So
what inspired you? Okay, I need to do this on my own, do something.
Well, you know, when you become sort of obsessed with something, you just live and breathe it. And it, I guess I'm more of a creative type person where you just, you have that constant need. What is satisfying to you in life is to create and accomplish things. And so I think, you know, it's just it's an extension of your ego, I guess. I don't know. It's just like you want to create, you know. Like I've always been, you know, growing up, I was into music. I was into, you know, skateboarding. You know, just all those things are kind of like, I don't know, they're creative outlets more so than just.
I can relate to that. I can see how wine definitely could.
You know, I'm not saying I'm an artist, but I appreciate the arts and I just like to produce things, I guess you could say.
Sure.
And I don't know, winemaking just kind of naturally became what was my outlet to output my personality, I guess you could say. Does the world need another wine? Probably not. But us winemakers think we're so important, so whatever. But it's funny. Try to stay level-headed over it all. So,
how long has Zapaltis Wines been out there? When did your first release come out?
In 2004 is the first fruit that I purchased to make wine. I bought some Syrah from Rosella's Vineyard down in Santa Lucia Highlands. I didn't really intend to start a company, but wanted to make some legit wine. So I think myself and my father, we pitched in some money just to buy some grapes and then make a little couple barrels on the side. Throughout the life of that aging, kind of got the idea like, hey, we should start a small label, but we didn't really think about it. And then as the wine was in barrel aging, I was like, wow, it tastes like real wine, you know? Like, you always second guess yourself. You make wine every day for other companies, but then when you're on your own, you're like, can I actually do this? And so it was pretty good quality, I thought. And so we just kind of put a business plan together and thought of a way to start a small winery. Started with 300 cases in 05, and that was kind of like the first official year. Fast forward a year and a half, and in 06, we started releasing the wines that were made in 04 and 05.
Okay, so and then how many cases are you up to now?
Currently, we produce 1,500 cases a year.
That's pretty small, isn't it? Even among small boutique wineries, it's fairly small.
Enough to be scary. 300 cases is fine because, you know, if you're losing money, you can pitch in some of your own cash. But once you get to a little over 1,000 cases, you know, you need it's a real business. You need cash flow. It has all the same concerns. So, yeah, it went from being like having a lemonade stand or a yard sale to a legit business, you know. So now it's scary. You deal with accountants and taxes and all that stuff. And some of that can kind of suck the soul out of it sometimes and wear you down. But all in all, it's good. And the result is going out there and seeing your wines in cool restaurants and getting emails from customers that said, hey, I had the 05 La Cruz Vineyard the other night and it was amazing with our dinner. And that's rewarding to me. So
we were talking earlier before that you had mentioned the way millennials now are getting access to wine. They're not reading magazines. They're not looking at wine ratings. They're either going, by word of mouth or looking at going on social media. I thought that was a pretty perceptive observation.
Well, it seems like what I've noticed is the people that are I'm like 34 years old, and some of the wine drinkers I meet, you know, come by the winery or I run into at events. It just seems like they're more against the scores, and they don't want these old guys to tell me what's good and what's not. And it just seems that people are more into the experience of like maybe meeting a small producer or going to a tasting room and spending time with the winemaker, barrel tasting, kind of discovering things on their own. you know, I don't think that's odd in any way. I think every generation somewhat rebels against what was done previously. But it just seems like more and more people you meet, you're like, I don't care what Wine Spectator says, or I don't care about Robert Parker or whatnot. And I think people still do, but I think it's just different. And I think small wineries would be dumb not to, like, at least try to stay connected in that way, because I don't think that scores and the discussion boards are the same as they used to be maybe 5 years ago. So we'll see. I could be wrong, but that's just kind of the gut feeling you get. And everyone I talk to just seems to be more into the word of mouth or more into actually experiencing things on your own. I think it's kind of like that thing of backpacking across Europe after college. You know, you like want to discover some crazy little place on your own. You don't want someone to tell you, go to Rome and check this out, or go to Paris and check this out. You want to get on the train and just do what happens naturally. And I think my gut feeling is that's kind of how the newer generation is experiencing wine. So,
in doing some research on you, I noticed that you really are interested in the connection between making wines that go with food. Is that the right way to describe?
I definitely have sort of an old, I like that old Frenchy lifestyle. I like the food and wine. I think wine belongs on the table. I could eat all day long, so I might as well have wine too. That being said, I drink wine on its own too. But to me, my whole goal with my wine is to make food-friendly wines. To me, making food-friendly wines is wines that just have good acidity, tend to be lower in alcohol, and maybe a little more elegant. Sometimes wines that have been pushed, they're a little more bigger style, monstrous. They just kind of, if they're higher alcohol, the viscosity of the wine just kind of just overtakes everything. And it's not to me, having a food-friendly wine has good acidity. So if you have something like that's a richer dish with a lot of cream or fat, the wine should kind of refresh your palate, and it should just be going back and forth throughout your meal. One shouldn't be killing the other.
Right.
So with my wines, I just try to make them in a style that fits that. So
now, are you a cook yourself?
I can hang in the kitchen, but the true superstar is my wife. She's a really good cook. She did some culinary school, but we eat very well at home. So she's as passionate about being in the kitchen as I am about making wine. So,
well, that's a great match.
It's pretty cool.
You guys are living the dream.
It's pretty cool, yeah. I mean, even when we say, oh, let's just have a simple meal. It's Tuesday night. We don't need to go all out. Somehow we end up in the kitchen for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then a nice dinner. And so it's pretty cool. And she really has a great palate herself. And so it's great. So when we have guests over or we see customers or something, a lot of times we'll put together some food to go with the wines so we can showcase what we're
sure.
doing.
That's kind of a question I ask different people. Like, you know, which wines do you, if you didn't drink yours, which wines
at home
do you like to drink? Yeah, at home.
At home, I rarely drink my own just because I'm immersed in them.
Okay.
By day. Sometimes you're sick of them by the time they get released. But that being said, I have my wines all the time. But at home, I probably go for a beer when I walk in the door, just to kind of reset after
the
day.
It's like that old saying, right? It takes a lot of beer to make a great wine.
Yeah, yeah. It's said all the time, and it's so cliche, but it's still very true, you know? So it's definitely do that. But I mean, I go in waves, but lately it's been a lot of white wines. I like exploring the world of white wines. It's a little more affordable, and there's so much diversity out there. I'll go on a kick where I'm really into Italian white wines for a while, and then I'm like, oh, I've been neglecting Spain for a while, mm-hmm. so go there. And then the old standby is white Burgundy for me. I'll never get sick of good old Chablis or anything from
sure.
Burgundy.
So you would characterize what you do as more French, in the French style?
Yeah, I just don't like, you know, these guys that say I make very Burgundian style wines, but they're in California. I think that's kind of stupid. I think you should embrace what you have in California. Yes, we get a little more fruit forward wines. We should embrace that. The trick is to harness the power of California. We have no problem getting our fruit ripe in California. So you just have to be tasteful with how you... You don't want to overdo it. So I'm very proud to make California wine. But I do have an expression that some would argue is very old world style. And I would agree with that. But I don't like to say, like, I'm making Burgundian style wines. I'm making
okay.
California wines, just going for a little more elegant style.
Right.
So.
Just a quick question. You mentioned Siduri. Tell me a little bit about that relationship and their wines. And
so when I came back from New Zealand in 2000, I was just sort of bopping around that summer and temping at different wineries, and the temp agency I was working for says, oh, do you want to try to get a harvest position? I have an interview for you at this winery called Siduri. If you're interested, they're looking for a harvest guy. So I did. And at the time, I was just getting into wine, becoming a wine geek, where I knew who the big producers were. I knew who Rocchioli was, who William Sullyan was, who Hanzel was, and the big names. But I hadn't heard of Siduri because I just hadn't. I wasn't to that level yet. They sent me on an interview there. I went to the winery, and I was surprised to see it was in a warehouse district. It was in a basically a big-ass warehouse. So I was driving through, and I was like, I think this is the right place. I pull up, I walk in, and you know, you open the door, and it's a real winery, but it's just not in a fancy castle.
Are they in Santa Rosa?
They're in the north end of town, Santa Rosa. So I met and interviewed with Adam and Diana. You know, they gave me a little tour of the place, and I saw, they had open-top fermenters. They were making lots of Pinot. So I was like, I'd known Pinot pretty well from La Crema and New Zealand and Chardonnay as well. So they were doing that, and they said, oh, yeah, and we're also making Syrah now. So we're starting a Syrah project, or they had just got it going. So I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. And I knew coming back from New Zealand that I needed to work at a small winery. That would be the way to learn the most and just have the most gratifying experience. So I started working for them right before harvest. And halfway through harvest, they asked me to come on full time. So I was sort of the cellar master for a couple of years. And then when their assistant winemaker, Scott Shapley, who's not Rossler Cellars, when he moved on to that job, I went in as the assistant and been in charge of that program since then. So I still work for them today full time, doing this on the side. They're very encouraging to help me start. Everyone's always surprised. They said, did they let you do this? Are they okay with this? And I guess it's maybe not that common to encourage someone to start their own company on the side, but they've been very supportive and they've opened a lot of doors for me. And I don't think we view it as competition. I think we have different clientele, and it's fun. We make different style wines, so we can go back and forth. We can harass each other about our wine styles, and it's for the greater good, I think, of the wine industry. So they've been very great. So thank you, Adam and Diana Lee.
Now, did you graduate from college in Wisconsin somewhere, or did you? What's your education like?
UW Eau Claire.
Okay.
Sometimes for over the course of a couple of years.
Sure.
It's funny, I was an honors graduate in high school, and then, you know, college hits, and I did the typical, discovered all the naughty stuff, and was less than focused for a couple of years, so I was in a band, and I just skateboarded.
What kind of music?
I was in this crazy band that played kind of like crazy, like almost like gypsy circus punk music.
Wow.
It was really odd, yeah. But we played a lot of shows and toured around a lot, but also partied a lot and that sort of thing. So
not the best lifestyle, I suppose.
Well, it's fun then.
It was fun, yeah.
Probably couldn't hang with it now. But then, you know, I signed up taking time off, and then I actually went back to the Chippewa Valley Technical College and got a sales and marketing degree there, finished that up, and then moved to California. So
nothing to do with wine, then. That's which is
no, but
which is
sales
good.
And marketing at the Chippewa Valley Technical College. It's really helped me. You know, working for Siduri, you can oversee how, kind of be a fly on the wall of how a small business operates, and then some of the marketing stuff. And so that's definitely helped me, I think, because there's a lot of great winemakers out there, but you still have to sell the stuff. So learning how to do the selling too. So it's all part of it. So it is strange, though, sometimes marketing your own, you know, like I said, it sort of like seems narcissistic sometimes. You're marketing yourself, you know, you're out there pushing the me, buy my wines, look at me, I'm so cool. So, but it's fun at the end of the day.
Well, people buy, I think they're buying what's behind that label, you know, they're buying their.
It's true, because I think in the old world.
You're the brand.
Yeah.
And that's how you have to look at it.
Because, like, it's so different. Like, in Burgundy, they market, it's more about the vineyard than the winemaker.
Right.
But in the States, the culture's different. So we market the brand. It's the branding and the winemaker, the personality behind what's in the bottle. Fine line. Try not to let your ego get out of hand. But that's my wife's good for keeping me grounded, smacking me around if I get too out of hand. So
what's kind of where you come down on it? Screw cap versus corks.
I think it's great. Screw caps are great. Corks are great too. You know, for wines that I don't intend on aging, you know, white wines that are meant to be drank early, or rosé wines, I'm cool with that. Or your everyday value wine that's really not meant for cellaring, screw caps are great. I kind of like corks for wines that you're setting down to age, just because the cork is porous and there's that exchange of air over time, and that's what helps the wine evolve. To me, that the screw caps can be sort of a time capsule, so the wine doesn't really change much in the screw cap. That's my opinion of it, but I don't have a political argument against one either way. I mean, it is sad that corks are expensive and it's a natural resource, and definitely, but screw caps are wonderful too. But I'll stick with corks on all my main wines. But you'll see my rosés and my entry-level Pinots probably have screw caps someday.
You know, a lot of the winemakers, they put so much effort into their wines, and so there's the fear of, you know, corked wines. They don't want to take that risk, which a lot of them seem to be moving towards screw caps.
Yeah, in no other industry could you say a 3% failure rate is acceptable. You know, it's like if you're manufacturing something, that would be in the auto industry or something, it'd be terrible for your company.
Right.
But we let it slide in the wine industry, which is sad, but I think it was way worse. Even 10 years ago, they said that the cork industry has always got their little reports, but I think they were like 8 to 10% not too long ago. And now I think they got it down to about 3% or less. And cross our fingers that they keep getting better.
Sure. So. All right. That's about all I have. Yeah, thanks.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Good to be in downtown Milwaukee. So.
You can find Zapaltis Wine on the web by going to zapaltiswine.com.